very subtle points. The other is a tiny, delicate girl, her skin the dappled brown of a doe, her hair a cloud of white around her head, and a miniature pair of blue-gray butterfly wings on her back. She's got at least some pixie in her, if not some imp. I recognize her now from the High King's full moon revel. She's the one who stole a belt from an ogre, weapons and pouches attached.
"I'm the bomb," she says. "I like blowing things up."
I nod. It's the kind of blunt thing I don't expect fairies to say, but I'm used to being around court fairies with their Baroque etiquette. I'm not used to the solitary fae. I'm at a loss as to how to speak with them. "So, is it just the three of you?"
"For now," says the roach. "We make sure Prince Dane stays alive and well informed about the doings of the court. We steal, sneak, and deceive to secure his coronation. And when he is king, we will steal, sneak, and deceive to make sure he stays on the throne."
I nod. After seeing what Baelkin is like, I want Dane on the throne more than ever. Matic will be by his side. And if I can make myself useful enough, maybe they'll get the rest of the gentry off my back.
"You can do two things the rest of us can't,"
the roach says.
"One, you can blend in with the human servants. Two, you can move among the gentry. We're going to teach you some other tricks. So until you get another mission directly from the prince, your job is what I say it is."
I nod. I expected something like that. I can't always get away. I skipped classes today, but I can't do that all the time, or someone will notice and ask where I've been. And Matic expects me to have dinner with him and Oriana and the rest of the family around midnight. The roach looks over at the ghost and shrugs.
"This is always the problem with infiltrating the court. Lots of etiquette taking up time. When can you get away?"
"I could sneak out after I'm supposed to be in bed," I tell them.
"Good enough,"
the roach says.
"One of us will meet you near the house and either train you or give you assignments. You need not always come here to the nest."
The ghost nods, as though my problems are reasonable. Part of the job. But I feel childish. They are a child's problems.
"So, let's initiate her," the bomb says, walking up to me.
I catch my breath. Whatever happens next, I can endure it. I have endured more than they can guess. But the bomb only starts laughing, and the roach gives her a playful shove. The ghost gives me a sympathetic look and shakes his head. His eyes, I notice, are a shifting hazel.
"If Prince Dane says you are part of the Court of Shadows, then you are. Try not to be too much of a disappointment, and we'll have your back."
I let out my breath. I am not sure that I wouldn't have preferred some ordeal, some way to prove myself. The bomb makes a face.
"You'll know you're really one of us when you get your name. Don't expect it anytime soon."
The ghost goes over to a cabinet and takes out a half-empty bottle of a pale greenish liquid and a stack of polished acorn cups. He pours out four shots.
"Have a drink, and don't worry,"
he tells me.
"It won't befuddle you any more than any other drink."
I shake my head, thinking of the way I felt after having the golden apple mashed into my face. Never do I want to feel out of control like that again. I'll pass. The roach knocks back his drink and makes a face, as though the liquor is scorching his throat.
"Suit yourself,"
he manages to choke out before he starts to cough. The ghost barely winces at the contents of his acorn. The bomb is taking tiny sips of hers. From her expression, I am extra glad I passed on it.
"Baelkin's going to be a problem,"
the roach says, explaining what I found. The bomb puts down her acorn.
"I mislike everything about this. If he was going to go to Eldred, he would have done it already. I had not considered that he might poison his father. The ghost stretches his lanky body as he gets up.
It's getting late. I should take the girl home.
Jude, I remind him. He grins.
I know a shortcut.
We go back into the tunnels, and following him is a challenge because, as his name suggests, he moves almost completely silently. Several times, I think he's left me alone in the tunnels. But just when I'm about to stop walking, I hear the faintest exhalation of breath or shuffle of dirt and persuade myself to go on. After what feels like an agonizingly long time, a doorway opens. The ghost is standing in it, and beyond him is the High King's wine cellar. He makes a small bow. This is your shortcut? I ask. He winks.
If a few bottles happen to fall into my satchel as we pass through, that's hardly my fault, is it?
I force out a laugh, the sound creaky and false in my ears. I'm not used to one of the folk including me in their jokes, at least not outside my family. I like to believe that I'm doing okay here in Faerie. I like to believe that even though I was drugged and nearly murdered at school yesterday, I am able to put that behind me today. I'm fine. But if I can't laugh, maybe I'm not so fine after all. I change into the blue shift I packed in the woods outside Maddox's grounds, despite being so tired that my joints hurt. I wonder if the folk are ever tired like that, if they ever ache after a long evening. The toad seems exhausted too, although maybe she's just full. As far as I can tell, most of what she did today was snap her tongue at passing butterflies and a mouse or two. It's full deep dark when I get back to the estate. The trees are lit with tiny sprites, and I see a laughing oak racing through them, pursued by Vivi and Taryn, and, oh hell, Locke. It's disorienting to see him here, impossibly out of context. Has he come because of me? With a shriek, Oak dashes over, clambering up the saddlebags and onto my lap.
Chase me!
He yells, out of breath, full of the wriggling ecstasy of childhood. Even fairies are young once. Impulsively, I hug him to my chest. He's warm, and smells of grass and deep woods. He lets me do it for a moment, small arms twining around my neck, small horned head butting against my chest. Then, laughing, he slides down and away, throwing a puckish glance back to see if I'll follow. Growing up here in Faerie, will he learn to scorn mortals? When I am old and he is still young, will he scorn me too? Will he become cruel like Cardan? Will he become brutal like Matic? I have no way of knowing. I step off the toad, foot in the stirrup as I swing my body down. I pat just above her nose. Her golden eyes drift shut. In fact, she seems a little like she might be asleep until I yank on the reins, leading her back toward the stables.
Hello, Locke says, jogging up to me. Now, where might you have gone off to?
None of your business, I tell him. But I soften the words with a smile. I can't help it.
Ah, a lady of mystery. My favorite kind.
He's wearing a green doublet, with slits to show his silk shirt underneath. His fox eyes are alight. He looks like a fairy lover stepped out of a ballad, the kind where no good comes to the girl who runs away with him.
I hope you'll consider returning to classes tomorrow, he says.
Vivi continues to chase Oak. But Taryn has stopped near a large elm tree. She watches me with the same expression she had on the tournament field, as though if she concentrates hard enough, she can will me into not offending Locke.
You mean so your friends know they haven't chased me off? I say. Does it matter?
He looks at me oddly.
You're playing the great game of kings and princes.
of queens and crowns, aren't you? Of course it matters. Everything matters.
I am not sure how to interpret his words. I didn't think I was playing that kind of game at all. I thought I was playing the game of pissing off people who hated me already and eating the consequences.
Come back. You and Taryn both should return. I told her so.
I turn my head, looking for my twin in the yard, but she is no longer by the elm. Vivi and Oak are disappearing over a hill. Perhaps she has gone with them. We get to the stables, and I return the toad to her pen. I fill her water station from a barrel in the center of the room, and fine mist appears, raining down on her soft skin. The horses nicker and stamp as we leave. Locke watches this all in silence.
May I ask you something else?
Locke says, glancing in the direction of the manor. I nod.
Why haven't you told your father what's been happening?
Maddox stables are very impressive. Maybe standing in them, Locke was reminded of just how much power and influence the general has. But that doesn't mean I am the inheritor of that power. Maybe Locke should also remember that I am merely one of the by-blow children of Maddox's human wife. Without Maddox and his honor, no one would care about me.
You mean so he can go stomping into our classes with a broadsword, killing everyone in sight?
I ask, instead of correcting Locke about my station in life. Locke's eyes widen. I guess that wasn't what he meant.
I thought that your father would pull you out, and that if you didn't tell him, it was because you wanted to stay.
I give a short laugh. That's not what he'll do at all. Maddox is not a fan of surrender. In the cool dark of the stables, with the snorting of fairy horses all around us, he takes my hands.
Nothing there will be the same without you.
Since I never intended to quit, it's nice to have someone making all this effort to get me to do something I would have done anyway. And the way he's looking at me, the intensity of it, is so nice that I am embarrassed. No one has ever looked at me this way. I can feel the heat of my cheeks and wonder if the shadows help cover it up at all. Right then, I feel as though he sees everything, every hope of my heart, every stray thought I've had before falling into an exhausted sleep each dawn. He brings one of my hands up to his mouth and presses his lips against my palm. My whole body tenses. I am suddenly too warm, too everything. His breath is a soft susurration against my skin. With a gentle tug, he pulls me closer. His arm is around me. He leans in for a kiss, and my thoughts slide away. This can't be happening.
Jude?
I hear Taryn call uncertainly from nearby, and I stagger away from Locke.
Jude, are you still in the stable?
Here, I say, my face hot. We emerge into the night to find Oriana on the steps of the house, hauling Oak inside. Vivi is waving to him as he tries to squirm free from his mother's grip. Taryn has her hands on her hips.
Oriana has called everyone in to dinner,
Taryn informs us both grandly.
She wants Locke to stay and eat with us.
He makes a bow.
You may inform your lady mother that though I am honored to be asked to her table, I would not so impose myself on her. I only wanted to speak with you both. I will, however, call again. You may be sure of that.
You talked to Jude about school?
There's trepidation in Taryn's voice. I wonder what they spoke about before I returned. I wonder if he persuaded her to attend the lectures again. And if so, how he did it.
Until tomorrow,
he says to us with a wink. I watch him walk off, still overwhelmed. I don't dare look at Taryn, for fear she will see all of it on my face. The whole day's events. The almost kiss. I am not ready to talk, so I am the one who avoids her for once. Skipping up the steps with as much nonchalance as I can muster, I head to my room to change for dinner. I forgot that I asked Matic to teach me swordplay and strategy. But after dinner, he gives me a stack of military history books from his personal library.
"When you're done reading these, we will talk,"
he informs me.
"I will set you a series of challenges, and you will tell me how you might overcome them with the resources I give you."
I think he expects me to object and insist on more swordplay, but I am too tired to even think of it. Flopping down on my bed an hour later, I decide that I am not going to even take off the blue silk dress I am wearing. My hair is still disarranged, although I tried to improve it with a few pretty pins. I should take those out at least, I tell myself, but I can't seem to make any movement toward doing so. My door opens, and Taryn comes in, hopping up onto my bed.
"Okay," she says, poking me in the side. "What did Locke want?"
"He said he had to talk to you." "He's nice," I say, rolling over and folding my arms behind my head, staring up at the folds of fabric gathered above me. Not totally Cardin's puppet like the rest of them. Taryn has an odd expression on her face, like she wants to contradict me, but is holding herself back.
"Whatever. Spill."
"About Locke?" I ask. She rolls her eyes.
"About what happened with him and his friends."
"They're never going to respect me if I don't fight back," I tell her. She sighs.
"They're never going to respect you, period."
I think of crawling across the grass, my knees dirty, the savor of the fruit in my mouth. Even now I can taste the echo of it, the emptiness it would fill, the giddy, delirious joy it promises. Taryn goes on.
"You came home practically naked yesterday, smeared with fairy fruit. Isn't that bad enough? Don't you care?"
Taryn has pulled her whole body back against one of the posts of my bed. "I am tired of caring," I say.
"Why should I?" "Because they could kill you."
"They better," I say to her. "Because anything less than that isn't going to work."
"Do you have a plan for stopping them?" she asks. "You said you were going to defy Cardin by being your awesome self, and if he tried to take you down, you'd take him down with you. How are you going to manage that?"
"I don't know exactly," I admit. She throws up her hands in frustration.
"No, look," I say. "Every day that I don't beg Cardin for forgiveness over a feud he started is a day I win. He can humiliate me, but every time he does and I don't back down, he makes himself less powerful. After all, he's throwing everything he's got at someone as weak as I am, and it's not working. He's going to take himself down."
She sighs and comes over to me, laying her head against my chest, putting her arms around me. Against my shoulder, she whispers, "He's Flint. You're Tinder." I hug her closer and make no promises. We stay like that for a long moment.
"Did Locke threaten you?"
she asks softly.
"It was so odd that he came here looking for you, and then you had such a weird expression when I walked into the stables."
"No, nothing bad," I tell her. "I don't know exactly what he came for, but he kissed my hand. It was nice, like out of a storybook."
"Nice things don't happen in storybooks," Taryn says.
"Or when they do happen, something bad happens next. Because otherwise, the story would be boring, and no one would read it." It's my turn to sigh. I know it's stupid, thinking well of one of Cardin's friends, but he really did help me. He stood up to Cardin. "But I'd rather talk about you. There's someone, isn't there? When you said you were going to fall in love, you were talking about someone in particular. Not that I'd be the first to green gown her."
"There's a boy," she says slowly. He's going to declare himself at Prince Dane's coronation. He's going to ask for my hand from Matic. And then everything is going to change for me. I think of her weeping, standing beside Cardin. I think of how angry she's been that I am feuding with him. I think of that, and a cold and terrible dread creeps over me. Who? I demand. Please not Cardin. Anyone but Cardin. I promise not to tell anyone, she says. Even you. Our promises don't matter, I say, thinking of Prince Dane's Gesh still freezing my tongue, of how little any of them trust us. No one expects us to have any honor. Everyone knows we lie. She gives me a stern, disapproving look. It's a fairy prohibition. If I break it, he'll know. I need to show him I can live like one of the folk.
Okay, I say slowly.
Be happy for me, she says. And I feel cut to the quick. She has found her place in fairy, and I guess I have found mine. But I can't help worrying. Just tell me something about him. Tell me that he is kind. Tell me that you love him, and that he's promised to be good to you. Tell me. He's a fairy, she says. They don't love the way we do. And I think you would like him. There. That's something. That doesn't sound like Cardin, whom I despise. But I am not sure I can find her answer reassuring either. What does it mean, I would like him? Does that mean we've never met? What does it mean that he doesn't love the way we do? I am happy for you. Honest, I say. Although I am more worried than anything. This is exciting. When Oriana's dressmaker comes, you're going to have to make sure you get an extra pretty gown. Taryn relaxes. I just want everything to be better. For both of us. I reach over to my bedside table to retrieve the book I stole from Hollow Hall. Remember this? I ask, lifting up the collected Alice's Adventures in Wonderland book. When I do, a folded piece of paper slips out and flutters to the floor. We used to read that when we were little, she says, grabbing for the book. Where did you get it? I found it, I say, not able to explain whose bookshelf it had come from or why I had been in Hollow Hall in the first place. To test the Gesh, I try to say the words, spying for Prince Dane. My mouth will not move. My tongue stays still. A wave of panic washes over me, but I push it back. This is a small price for what he's given me. Taryn doesn't press for more information. She's too busy flipping through the pages and reading bits of it aloud. While I can't quite remember the cadence of my mother's voice, I think I hear an echo of it in Taryn's. Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place, she reads. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. I reach down surreptitiously and shove the fallen paper under my pillow. I plan to unfold it once she returns to her room, but instead I fall asleep, long before the story is over. I wake in the early morning, alone, needing to pee. I pad into my bath area, lift my skirts, and do my business in the copper basin left there for this purpose. Shame heating my face, even though I am alone. It is one of the most humbling aspects of being human. I know that fairies are not gods. Maybe I know that better than any mortal alive. But neither have I ever seen one hunched over a bedpan. Back in bed, I push aside the curtain and let the sunlight spill in, brighter than any lamp. I take the folded up paper from behind my pillow. Smoothing it out, I see Cardin's furious, arrogant handwriting scrawled over the page, taking up all available space. In some places, he pressed the nib so angrily that the paper tore. Jude, it reads. each hateful rendering of my name like a punch to the gut. Jude, 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 Jude.
Chapter 15. The dressmaker comes early the next afternoon, a long-fingered fairy called Brambleweft. Her feet are turned backward, giving her an odd gait. Her eyes are like those of a goat, brown with a horizontal line of black just at the center. She is wearing an example of her work, a woven dress with embroidered lines of thorns making a striped pattern down the length of it. She has brought with her bolts of fabric, some of it stiff gold, one that changes color like iridescent beetle wings. Beside that, she tells us, is a spider silk so fine that it could have fit through the eye of a needle 3 times over, and yet strong enough to have to be cut with silver scissors magicked to never lose their edge. The purple fabric shot through with gold and silver is so bright that it seems like moonlight itself puddling over the cushions. All the fabrics are draped onto the couch in Oriana's parlor for us to inspect. Even Vivi is drawn to run her fingers over the cloth, an absent smile on her face. There is nothing like this in the mortal world, and she knows it. Oriana's current maid, a hairy, wizened creature named Toadfloss, brings tea and cakes, meat and jam, all piled on a massive silver tray. I pour myself tea and drink it without cream, hoping it will settle my stomach. The terror of the last few days is at my heels, making me shudder without warning. The memory of the fairy fruit keeps rising unbidden to my tongue, along with the cracked lips of the servants in Baelkin's palace, and the sound of the leather as it struck Prince Cardin's bare back. And my own name, written over and over and over. I thought I knew how much Cardin hated me. But looking at that paper, I realized I had no idea. And he'd hate me even more still if he knew I had seen him on his knees, beaten by a human servant. A mortal. For an extra bit of humiliation. An extra dose of rage. Jude, Oriana says, and I realize that I've been staring off toward the window and the fading light. Yes? I put on a bright, false smile. Taryn and Vivienne begin to laugh. And just who are you thinking about with a dreamy expression like that on your face? Oriana asks, which makes Vivi laugh again. Taryn doesn't, probably because she thinks I am an idiot. I shake my head, hoping I have not gone red-faced. No, it wasn't anything like that. I was just, I don't know. It doesn't matter. What were we talking about?
The seamstress wishes to measure you first, Oriana says, since you're the youngest.
I look over at Brambleweft, who holds a string between her hands. I hop up onto the box she has set before her, holding out my arms. I am a good daughter today. I am going to get a pretty gown. I will dance at Prince Dane's coronation until my feet bleed.
Don't scowl, the seamstress says.
Before I can stammer apologies, she continues, voice pitched low.
I was told to sew this dress with pockets that can conceal weapons and poisons and other little necessities. We'll make sure that's done while still showing you to great advantage.
I almost stumble off the box. I am so surprised. That's wonderful, I whisper back, knowing better than to thank her. Fairies don't believe in dismissing gratitude with a few words. They believe in debts and bargains. And the person I am meant to be most indebted to is not here. Prince Dane is the one who expects to be repaid.
She smiles, pins in her mouth, and I grin back at her. I will repay him. Although it seems I will have much to repay him for, I will make him proud of me. Everyone else, I will make very, very sorry. When I look up, Vivi is watching me suspiciously. Taryn is next to be measured. As she gets on the box, I go and drink more tea. Then I eat 3 sugary cakes and a strip of ham.
Where did you go the other day?
Vivi asks as I gulp down the meat like some kind of raptor bird. I have woken ravenous. I think of how I fled from our conversation on my way to Hollow Hall. I can't exactly deny that, not without explaining more about where I was going than my geshed tongue will allow. I shrug, one-shouldered.
I made one of the other gentry kids describe what happened to you at that lecture,
Vivi says.
You could have died. The only reason you're alive is that they didn't want their game to be over.
That's the way they are, I remind her.
That's the way things are. Do you want the world to be different than it is? Because this is the world we get, Vivi. It's not the only world, she says softly.
It's my world, I say, my heart hammering in my chest. I stand before she can tell me otherwise. My hands are shaking, though, and my palms are sweaty when I go to finger the fabrics. Ever since I staggered home through the woods in my underwear, I have been trying to feel nothing about what happened. I am afraid that if I begin to feel, I won't be able to bear it. I am afraid that the emotion will be like a wave sucking me under. It's not the first awful thing I have endured and pushed it into the back of my brain. That's how I've been coping, and if there's another, better way, I do not know it. I focus my attention on the cloth until I can breathe evenly again, until the panic dissipates. There's a velvet blue-green, reminding me of the lake at dusk. I find an amazing, fantastical fabric embroidered with moths and butterflies and ferns and flowers. I lift it up, and underneath is a bolt of beautiful fog-gray cloth that ripples like smoke. They're so very pretty. The kind of fabrics that princesses in fairy tales wear. Of course, Taryn is right about stories. Bad things happen to those princesses. They are pricked with thorns, poisoned by apples, married to their own fathers. They have their hands cut off, and their brothers turned into swans, their lovers chopped up and planted in basil pots. They vomit up diamonds. When they walk, it feels as though they're walking on knives. They still manage to look nice.
I want that one,
Taryn says, pointing to the bolt of fabric I'm holding, the one with the embroidery. She's done being measured. Vivi is up there, holding out her arms, watching me in that unnerving way she has, as though she knows my very thoughts.
Your sister found it first, Oriana says.
Please,
Taryn says to me, bending her head and looking up through her eyelashes. She's joking, but she's not. She needs to look nice for this boy who is supposed to declare himself at the coronation. She doesn't understand what use my looking nice would be, me with my grudges and feuds. With a half smile, I set down the bolt.
Sure, all yours.
Taryn kisses me on the cheek. I guess we're back to normal. If only everything in my life were so easily resolved. I choose a different cloth, the dark blue velvet.
Vivienne chooses a violet that seems to be a silvery gray when she turns it over her hand.
Oriana chooses a blush pink for herself and a cricket green for Oak. Brambleweft starts to sketch. Billowing skirts and cunning little capes. Corsets stitched with fanciful creatures. Butterflies alighting along arms and in elaborate headpieces. I am charmed at the alien vision of myself. My corset will have two golden beetles stitched in what looks like a breastplate. With Maddox moon crest and elaborate swirls of shining thread continuing down my front. And tiny sheared drop sleeves of more gold. It will certainly be clear to what household I belong. We are still making small changes when Oak runs in, being chased by Gnarbone. Oak spots me first and scrambles onto my lap, throwing his arms around my neck and giving me a small bite just beneath my shoulder. "Ow!" I say in surprise, but he just laughs. It makes me laugh too. He's kind of a weird kid, maybe because he's a fairy, or maybe because all kids, human or inhuman, are equally weird. "Do you want me to tell you a story about a little boy who bit a stone and lost all his pearly white teeth?" I ask him in what I hope is a menacing fashion, sticking my fingers under his armpits to tickle him.
"Yes,"
he says immediately between breathless giggles and shrieks. Oriana strides over to us, her face full of trouble. "That's very kind of you, but we ought to begin dressing for dinner." She pulls him off my lap and into her arms. He begins screaming and kicking his legs. One of the kicks lands against my stomach, hard enough to bruise, but I don't say anything.
"Story!"
he shouts.
"I want the story!"
"Jude is busy right now," she says, carrying his squirming body toward the door, where Gnarbone is waiting to take him back to the nursery. "Why don't you ever trust me with him?" I shout, and Oriana wheels around, shocked that I said a thing we don't say. I am shocked too, but I can't stop. "I'm not a monster. I've never done anything to either of you."
"I want the story,"
Oak whines, sounding confused. "That's enough," Oriana says sternly, as though we've all been arguing. "We will speak about this later with your father." With that, she strides from the room. "I don't know whose father you're talking about, because he's sure not mine," I call after her. Taryn's eyes go saucer wide.
Vivienne has a small smile on her face.
She takes a minute sip of tea, and then she raises the cup in my direction in salute. The seamstress is looking down and away, leaving us to our private family moment. I cannot seem to contort myself back into the shape of a dutiful child. I am coming unraveled. I am coming undone. The next day at school, Taryn walks beside me, swinging her lunch basket. I keep my head high and my jaw set. I have my little knife with me, cold iron, tucked into one of the pockets of my skirt, and more salt than I reasonably need. I even have a new necklace of rowan berries, sewn by Tatterfell and worn because there was no way she could know I didn't need it. I dally in the palace garden to gather a few more things.
"Are you allowed to pick those?" Taryn asks,
but I do not answer her. In the afternoon, we attend a lecture in a high tower, where we are taught about bird songs. Every time I feel as though my courage will falter, I let my fingers brush the cool metal of the blade. Locke looks over, and when he catches my eye, he winks. From the other side of the room, Cardin scowls at the lecturer, but does not speak. When he moves to take an inkpot from a satchel, I see him wince. I think about how sore his back must be, how it must hurt to move. But if he holds himself a little more stiffly as he sneers, that seems to be the only difference in his manner. He looks well practiced in hiding pain. I think of the note I found, of the press of his nibbed pen hard enough to send flecks of ink spattering as he wrote my name. Hard enough to dig through the page, maybe to scar the desk beneath. If that's what he did to the paper, I shudder to think what he wants to do to me. After school, I practice with Matic. He shows me a particularly clever block, and I do it over and over again, better and faster, surprising even him. When I go inside, covered in sweat,
I pass Oak, who is running somewhere, dragging my stuffed snake after him on a dirty rope. He's clearly stolen the snake from my room.
Oak, I call after him, but he's up the stairs and away.
I sluice off in my bath and then, alone in my room, unpack my school bag. Tucked down in the bottom, wrapped in a leftover piece of paper, is a single worm-eaten fairy fruit I picked up on the way home. I set it on a tray and pull on leather gloves. Then I take out my knife and cut it into pieces. Tiny slivers of squishy golden fruit. I have researched fairy poisons in dusty, hand-scribed books in Maddox's library. I read about the blusher mushroom, a pale fungus that blooms with beads of a red liquid that looks uncomfortably like blood. Small doses cause paralysis, while large doses are lethal, even for the folk. Then there is death sweet, which causes a sleep that lasts 100 years, and wraithberry, which makes your blood race until your heart stops. And fairy fruit, of course, which one book called Everapple. I take out a flask of pine liquor, nicked from the kitchens, thick and heavy as sap. I drop the fruit into it to keep it fresh. My hands are shaking. The final piece, I put on my tongue. The rush of it hits me hard, and I grip my teeth against it. Then, while I'm feeling stupid, I take out the other things. A leaf of wraithberry from the palace garden. A petal from a flower of death sweet. The tiniest bead of juice from the blusher mushroom. From each, I cut away a tinier portion and swallow. Mithridatism, it's called. Isn't that a funny name? The process of eating poison to build up immunity. So long as I don't die from it, I'll be harder to kill. I do not make it downstairs for dinner. I am too busy retching, too busy shivering, and sweating. I fall asleep on the bath area of my room, spread out on the floor. That's where the ghost finds me. I wake to his poking me in the stomach with the foot of his boot. It's only grogginess that keeps me from crying out.
Rise, Jude, the ghost says. The roach wants you to train tonight.
I push myself up, too exhausted to disobey. Outside on the dewy grass, with the first rays of sun creeping across the island, the ghost shows me how to climb trees silently. How to put down a foot without snapping a branch or crackling a dried leaf. I thought I'd learned how in my lessons at the palace, but he shows me mistakes my teachers didn't bother correcting. I try, over and over. Mostly, I fail. Good, he says, once my muscles are shaking. He's spoken so little that his voice startles me. He could more easily pass for human than Vivi, with the subtler points on his ears, light brown hair, and hazel eyes. And yet, he seems unknowable to me, both calmer and colder than she is. The sun is almost up. The leaves are turning gold.
Keep practicing. Sneak up on your sisters.
When he grins, with sandy hair falling over his face, he seems younger than I am. But I'm sure he's not. And when he goes, he does it in such a way that it appears like vanishing. I head back home and use what I've just learned to slyfoot my way past the servants on the stairs. I make it to my room, and this time when I collapse, I manage to do it in my bed. Then I get up the next day and do everything all over again. Chapter 16. Attending lectures is harder than ever. For one thing, I am sick. My body fighting the effects of the fruit and the poisons I am forcing down. For another, I am exhausted from training with Matic and training with Dane's Court of Shadows. Matic gives me puzzles, 12 goblin knights to storm a fortress, 9 untrained gentry to defend one, and then asks for my answers each evening after dinner. The Roach orders me to practice moving through the crowds of courtiers without being noticed, to eavesdrop without seeming interested. The bomb teaches me how to find the weak spot in a building, the pressure point on a body. The ghost teaches me how to hang from rafters and not be seen, to line up a shot with a crossbow, to steady my shaking hands. I am sent on 2 more missions to get information. First, I steal a letter addressed to Elowen from a knight's desk in the palace. The next time, I wear the clothing of a fairy bride and walk through a party to the private chambers of the lovely Terrakand, one of Prince Baelkin's consorts, where I take a ring from a desk. In neither case am I allowed to know the significance of what I stole. I attend lectures beside Cardin, Nicasia, Valerian, and all the gentry children who laughed at my humiliation. I do not give them the satisfaction of my withdrawing. But since the incident with the fairy fruit, there are no more skirmishes. I bide my time. I can only assume they are doing the same. I am not foolish enough to think we are done with one another. Locke continues his flirtation. He sits with Taryn and me when we take our lunch, spread out on a blanket, watching the sunset. Occasionally, he walks me home through the woods, stopping to kiss me near a copse of fir trees just before Maddox's estate. I only hope he doesn't taste the bitterness of poison on my lips. I do not understand why he likes me, but it is exciting to be liked. Taryn doesn't seem to understand it either. She regards Locke with suspicion. Perhaps since I am worried over her mysterious paramour, it is fitting that she seems equally worried over mine.
Are you enjoying yourself?
I overhear Nicasia ask Locke once as he joins them for a lecture.
Cardin won't forgive you for what you're doing with her.
I pause, unable to pass by without listening for his answer. But Locke only laughs.
Is he more angry that you chose me over him, or that I chose a mortal over you?
I startle, not sure I heard him right. She's about to answer when she spots me. Her mouth curls.
Little mousy, she says. Don't believe his sugared tongue.
The Roach would despair of me if he saw how badly I fumbled my newfound skills. I did nothing he taught me. I neither concealed myself nor blended in with others to avoid notice. At least no one would suspect me of knowing much about spycraft. So has Cardin forgiven you? I ask her, pleased by her stricken look. Too bad. I hear a prince's favor is a really big deal.
What need have I for princes? She demands. My mother is a queen.
There's much I could say about her mother, Queen Orla, who is planning a poisoning, but I bite my tongue. In fact, I bite it so hard that I don't say anything at all. I just walk to where Taryn is sitting, a small, satisfied smile on my face. More weeks pass until the coronation is mere days away. I am so tired that I fall asleep whenever I put my head down. I even fall asleep in the tower during a demonstration of moth summoning.
The susurration of their wings lulls me, I guess. It doesn't take much.
I wake on the stone floor. My head is ringing, and I am scrambling for my knife. I don't know where I am. For a moment, I think that I must have fallen. For a moment, I think I am paranoid. Then I see Valerian grinning down at me. He has pushed me out of my chair. I know it just from the look on his face. I have not yet become paranoid enough. Voices sound from outside, the rest of our classmates having their luncheon on the grass as evening rolls in. I hear the shrieks of the youngest children, probably chasing one another over blankets. Where's Taryn? I ask, because it wasn't like her not to wake me.
She promised not to help you, remember?
Valerian's golden hair hangs over one eye. As usual, he's clad entirely in red, a tone so deep that it might appear black at first glance.
Not by word or by deed.
Of course. Stupid me to forget I was on my own. I push myself up, noticing a bruise on my calf as I do. I am not sure how long I was sleeping. I brush off my tunic and trousers. What do you want?
I'm disappointed,
he says slyly.
You bragged about how you were going to best Cardin, and yet you've done nothing, sulking after one little prank.
My hand slides automatically to the hilt on my knife. Valerian lifts my necklace of rowan berries from his pocket and smirks at me. He must have cut it from my throat while I slept. I shudder at the thought that he was so close to me that instead of slicing the necklace, he could have sliced skin.
Now, you will do what I say.
I can practically smell the glamour in the air. He's weaving magic with his words.
Call down to Cardin. Tell him he's won. Then jump from the tower. After all, being born mortal is like being born already dead.
The violence of it, the awful finality of his command is shocking. A few months ago, I would have done it. I would have said the words. I would have leapt. If I hadn't made that bargain with Dane, I would be dead. Valerian may have been planning my murder since the day he choked me. I remember the light in his eyes then, the eagerness with which he watched me gasp. Taryn had warned me I was going to get myself killed, and I bragged that I was ready for it. But I am not. I think I'll take the stairs, I tell Valerian, hoping I don't seem half as shaken as I am. Then, acting as though everything is normal, I go to move past him. For a moment, he just looks confused, but his confusion quickly morphs into rage. He blocks my escape, moving in front of the steps.
I commanded you. Why don't you obey me?
Looking him dead in the eye, I force myself to smile. You had the advantage of me twice. And twice you gave it away. Good luck getting it again. He's sputtering, furious.
You're nothing. The human species pretends it is so resilient. Mortal lives are one long game of make-believe. If you couldn't lie to yourselves, you'd cut your own throats to end your misery.
I am struck by the word species, by the idea that he thinks I am something entirely else, like an ant, or a dog, or a deer. I am not sure he's wrong, but I don't like the thought. I don't feel particularly miserable right at the moment. I can't show him I am afraid. His mouth curls.
What happiness do you have? Rutting and breeding. You'd go mad if you accepted the truth of what you are. You are nothing. You barely exist at all. Your only purpose is to create more of your kind before you die some pointless and agonizing death.
I look him in the eye. And? He seems taken aback, although the sneer doesn't leave his face. Yeah, sure. I am going to die. And I am a big liar. So what? He pushes me against the wall, hard.
So you lose. Admit that you lost.
I try to shrug him off, but he grabs for my throat, fingers pressing hard enough to cut off my airflow.
I could kill you right now, he says, and you would be forgotten. It would be as though you'd never been born.
There is no doubt in my mind that he means it. No doubt at all. Gasping, I pull the knife from my little pocket and stab him in the side, right between his ribs. If my knife had been longer, I would have punctured his lung. His eyes go wide with shock. His grip on me loosens. I know what Matic would say, to push the blade higher,
go for an artery, go for his heart. But if I manage it, I will have murdered one of the favored sons of Fairy. I cannot even guess the punishment.
You're no killer.
I balk and pull the knife free, running out of the room. I shove the bloody blade into my pocket. My boots clatter on the stone as I head for the stairs. Looking back, I see him on his knees, pressing a hand to his side to staunch the blood. He lets out a hiss of pain that makes me recall my knife is cold iron. Cold iron hurts fairies a lot. I could not be gladder of carrying it. I round the corner and nearly run down Taryn.
Jude, she exclaims. What happened?
Come on, I tell her, dragging her toward the other students. There's blood on my knuckles, blood on my fingers, but not much. I rub it off on my tunic.
What did he do to you?
Taryn cries as I hustle her along. I tell myself that I don't mind that she left me. It wasn't her job to stick out her neck, especially when she made it abundantly clear she didn't want any part of this fight. Is there a treacherous part of me that's pissed off and sad that she didn't kick me awake and damn the consequences? Sure. But even I didn't guess how far Valerian would go or how fast he'd get there. We're crossing the lawn when Cardan veers in our direction. He's wearing loose clothes and carrying a practice sword. His eyes narrow at the blood, and he points the wooden stick at me.
You seem to have cut yourself.
I wonder if he's surprised that I'm alive. I wonder if he watched the tower the whole time during his luncheon, waiting for the amusing spectacle of me jumping to my death. I take the knife out from under my tunic and show it to him, stained a flinty red. I smile. I could cut you, too.
Jude,
Taryn says. She's clearly shocked by my behavior. She should be. My behavior is shocking.
Oh, go already,
Cardan tells her, waving her off with one hand.
Stop boring us both.
Taryn takes a step back. I'm surprised, too. Is this part of the game?
Are your dirty blade and even dirtier habits supposed to mean something?
His words are airy, drawling. He's looking at me as though I'm being uncouth by pointing a weapon at him, even though he's the one with the minion who assaulted me. Twice! He's looking at me as though we're going to share some kind of witty repartee. But I am not sure what to say. Is he really not worried about what I might have done to Valerian? Could he possibly not know Valerian attacked me? Taryn spots Locke and takes off toward him, hurrying across the field. They converse for a moment. Then Taryn departs. Cardan notices my noticing. He sniffs, as though the very smell of me offends him. Locke starts toward us, all loose limbs and shining eyes. He gives me a wave. For a moment, I feel almost safe. I am immensely grateful to Taryn for sending him over. I'm immensely grateful to Locke for coming. You think I don't deserve him, I say to Cardan. He smiles slowly, like the moon slipping beneath the waves of the lake.
Oh, no. I think you're perfect for each other.
A few moments later, Locke has his arm thrown around my shoulders.
Come on, he says. Let's get out of here.
And so, without a backward glance at any of them, we do. We walk through the crooked forest, where all the trees are bowed in the same direction as though they've been blown by a strong wind since they were saplings. I stop to pick a few blackberries from prickly stems of bushes growing between them. I have to blow tiny sugar ants from each before putting it in my mouth. I offer a berry to Locke, but he demurs. So, in short, Valerian tried to kill me, I say, finishing my story. and I stabbed him. His fox eyes are steady on me.
You stabbed Valerian?
So, I might be in some trouble. I take a deep breath. He shakes his head.
Valerian won't tell anyone he was bested by a mortal girl.
What about Cardan? Won't he be disappointed his plan didn't work? I gaze out at the sea, visible between the trunks of the trees. It seems to stretch on to forever.
I doubt he even knew about it,
Locke says, and smiles at my surprise.
Oh, he'd like to make you believe he's our leader. But it's more that Nikasia likes power. I like dramatics, and Valerian likes violence. Cardan can provide us with all three. Or at least, excuses for all three.
Dramatics? I echo.
I like for things to happen, for stories to unfold. And if I can't find a good enough story, I make one.
He looks every inch the trickster in that moment.
I know you overheard Nikasia talking about what was between us. She had Cardan, but only in leaving him for me did she gain power over him.
I ponder that for a moment, and while I do, I realize we're not taking our usual path to Maddox grounds. Locke has been leading me another way. Where are we going?
My domain,
he says with a grin, happy to be caught out.
It's not far. I think you'll like the hedge maze.
I have never been to one of their estates, save for Hollow Hall. In the human world, we children were always in the neighbors' yards, swinging and swimming and jumping. But the rules here are nothing the same. Most of the children in the High King's court are royals, sent from smaller courts to gain influence with the princes and princesses, and have no time for much else. Of course, in the mortal world, there are such things as backyards. Here, there are forest and sea, rocks and mazes, and flowers that are red only when they get fresh blood. I don't much like the idea of getting lost deliberately in a hedge maze, but I smile as though nothing could ever delight me more. I don't want to disappoint him.
There will be a gathering later, Locke continues. You should stay. I promise it will be diverting.
At that, my stomach clenches. I doubt he's having a party without his friends. That seems foolish, I say, to avoid refusing the invitation outright.
Your father doesn't like you to stay out late?
Locke gives me a pitying look. I know he's just trying to make me feel childish when he knows perfectly well why I shouldn't be there. But even though I am aware of what he's doing, it works. Locke's estate is more modest than Maddox, and less fortified. Tall spires covered in shingles of mossy bark rise between the trees. The spiraling vines of ivy and honeysuckle that twine up the sides turn the whole thing green and leafy. Wow, I say. I have ridden by here and seen those spires in the distance, but I never knew to whose house they belonged. Beautiful. He gives me a quick grin.
Let's go inside.
Although there is a pair of grand doors in the front, he takes me around to a small door on the side that leads directly to the kitchens. A fresh loaf of bread rests on the counter, along with apples, currants, and a soft cheese. But I do not see any servants who might have prepared this. I think, involuntarily, of the girl in Hollow Hall cleaning Cardan's fireplace. I wonder where her family thinks she is, and what bargain she made. I wonder how easily I could have been her. Is your family home? I ask, pushing that thought away.
I have none,
he tells me.
My father was too wild for the court. He liked the deep, feral woods far better than my mother's intrigues. He left, and then she died. Now it's just me.
That's terrible, I say, and lonely. He shakes off my words.
I've heard the story of your parents,
a tragedy suitable for a ballad. It was a long time ago. The last thing I want to talk about is Matic and murder. What happened to your mother? He makes a dismissive gesture in the air.
She got involved with the High King. In this court, that's enough. There was a child. His child, I suppose. And someone didn't want it born. Blusher Mushroom.
Although he began his speech airily, it doesn't end that way. Blusher Mushroom. I think of the letter I found in Balekin's house from Queen Orla. I try to convince myself that the note could not have referred to the poisoning of Locke's mother. That Balekin had no motive when Dane was already the High King's chosen heir. But no matter how I try to convince myself, I cannot stop thinking about the possibility of the horror of Nikasia's mother having had a hand in Locke's mother's death. I shouldn't have asked. That was rude of me.
We are children of tragedy.
He shakes his head and then smiles.
This is not how I meant to begin. I meant to give you wine and fruit and cheese. I meant to tell you how your hair is as beautiful as curling wood smoke. Your eyes, the exact color of walnuts. I thought I could compose an ode about it, but I am not very good at odes.
I laugh, and he covers his heart as though stung by cruelty.
Before I show you the maze, let me show you something else.
What's that? I ask, curious. He takes my hand.
Come,
he says, prankish, leading me through the house. We come to spiraling stairs. Up we go. Up and up and up. I feel dizzy. There are no doors and no landings. Just stone and steps and my heart beating loud in my chest. Just his slanted smiles and amber eyes. I try not to stumble or slip as I climb. I try not to slow down, no matter how lightheaded I feel. I think of Valyrian. Jump from the tower. I keep climbing, taking shallow breaths. You are nothing. You barely exist at all. When we get to the top, there's a small door, half our height. I lean against the wall, waiting for my balance to return, and watch Locke turn the elaborate silver knob. He ducks as he goes in. I steel myself, push off the wall, and follow. And gasp. We're on a balcony at the very top of the tallest tower, one higher than the tree line. From here, lit by starlight, I can see the maze below and the folly in the center. I can see the above-ground parts of the Palace of Elfheim and Maddox's estate and Belkin's Hollow Hall. I can see the sea that encircles the island and beyond it, the bright lights of human cities and towns through the ever-present mist. I have never looked directly from our world into theirs. Locke puts his hand against my back, between my shoulder blades.
At night, the human world looks as though it's full of fallen stars.
I lean into his touch, pushing away the awfulness of the climb, trying not to stand too close to the edge. Have you ever been there? He nods.
My mother took me when I was a child. She said our world would grow stagnant without yours.
I want to tell him that it's not mine, that I barely understand it, but I get what he's trying to say, that the correction would make it seem as though I didn't. His mother's sentiment is kind, certainly kinder than most views of the mortal world. She must have been kind herself. He turns me toward him, and then slowly brings his lips to mine. They're soft, and his breath is warm. I feel as distant from my body as the lights of the faraway city. My hand reaches for the railing. I grip it hard as his arm goes around my waist, to ground myself in what's happening, to convince myself that I am here, and that this moment, high above everything, is real. He draws back.
You really are beautiful,
he says. I am never so glad to know they cannot lie. This is incredible, I say, looking down. Everything looks so small, like on a strategy board. He laughs, as though I cannot possibly be serious.
I take it you spend a lot of time in your father's study.
Enough, I say. Enough to know what my odds are against Cardin.
Against Valerian and Nicasia?
Against you? He takes my hand.
Cardin is a fool. The rest of us don't matter.
His smile turns slanted.
But maybe this is part of your plan. Persuade me to take you to the very heart of my stronghold. Maybe you're about to reveal your evil scheme and bend me to your will. Just so you know, I don't think it will be very hard to bend me to your will.
I laugh despite myself. You're nothing like them.
Aren't I?
He asks. I give him a look. I don't know. Are you going to order me off this balcony? His eyebrows go up.
Of course not.
Well then, you're not like them, I say, poking him hard in the center of his chest. My hand flattens, almost unconsciously, letting the warmth of him seep up through my palm. I hadn't realized how cold I'd become, standing in the wind.
You're not the way they said you would be,
he says, bending toward me. He kisses me again. I don't want to think about the things they must have said. Not now. I want his mouth on mine, blotting out everything else. It takes us a long time to wend our way back down the stairs. My hands are in his hair. His mouth is on my neck. My back is against the ancient stone wall. Everything is slow and perfect and makes no sense at all. This can't be my life. This feels nothing like my life. We sit at the long, empty banquet table and eat cheese and bread. We drink pale green wine that tastes of herbs out of massive goblets that Locke finds in the back of a cabinet. They're so thick with dust, he has to wash them twice before we can use them. When we're done, he presses me back against the table, lifting me so that I am seated on it, so that our bodies are pressed together. It's exhilarating and terrifying, like so much a fairy. I am not sure I am very good at kissing. My mouth is clumsy. I am shy. I want to pull him closer and push him away at the same time. Fairies do not have a lot of taboos around modesty, but I do. I am afraid that my mortal body stinks of sweat, of decay, of fear. I am not sure where to put my hands, how hard to grab, how deep to sink my nails into his shoulders. And while I know what comes after kissing, while I know what it means to have his hands slide up over my bruised calf to my thigh, I have no idea how to hide my inexperience. He pulls back to look at me, and I try to keep the panic out of my eyes.
Stay tonight,
he murmurs. For a moment, I think he means with him. Like, with him. And my heart speeds with some combination of desire and dread. Then, abruptly, I remember there's going to be a party. That's what he's asking me to stay for. Those unseen servants, wherever they are, must be preparing the estate. Soon, Valerian, my would-be murderer, might be dancing in the garden. Well, maybe not dancing. He'll probably be leaning against a wall stiffly, with a drink in his hand, bandages around his ribs, and a new plan to murder me in his heart. If not new orders to murder me. From Cardin. Your friends won't like it, I say, sliding off the table.
They'll quickly be too drunk to notice. You can't spend your life locked up in Maddox's glorified barracks.
He gives me a smile that is clearly meant to charm me. It kind of works. I think about Dane's offer to give me a love mark on my brow, and wonder idly if Locke might have one, because, despite everything, I am tempted. I don't have the right clothes, I say, gesturing to the tunic I have on, stained with Valyrian's blood. He looks me up and down longer than an inspection of my garments requires.
I can find you a gown. I can find you anything you'd like. You asked me about Cardan, Valyrian, and Acacia. Come see them outside of school. Come see them be foolish and drunk and debased. See their vulnerabilities, the cracks in their armor. You've got to know them to beat them, right? I don't say you'll like them any better, but you don't need to like them.
I like you, I tell him. I like playing pretend with you.
Pretend?
He echoes, as though he's not sure if I'm insulting him. Of course, I say, going to the windows of the hall and looking out. Moonlight streams onto the leafy entrance to the maze. Torches are burning nearby, the flames flickering and wavering in the wind.
Of course we're pretending. We don't belong together, but it's fun anyway.
He gives me an evaluating, conspiratorial look.
Then let's keep doing it.
Okay, I say helplessly. I'll stay. I'll go to your party. I have had little fun in my life so far. The promise of more is difficult to resist. He leads me through several rooms until we come to double doors. For a moment, he hesitates, glancing back at me. Then he pushes them open, and we're in an enormous bedroom. A thick, oppressive layer of dust blankets everything. There are footprints, two sets. He's come in here before, but not many times.
The dresses in the closet were my mother's.
Borrow whatever you like, he says, taking my hand. Looking around this untouched room at the heart of the house, I understand the grief that made him lock it up for so long. I am glad to be let in. If I had a room full of my mother's things, I do not know if I would let anyone inside. I don't even know if I would brave it myself. He opens one of the closets. Much of the clothing is moth-eaten, but I can see what they once were. A skirt with a beaded pattern of pomegranates, another that pulls up, like a curtain, to show a stage with jeweled mechanical puppets underneath. There's even one stitched with the silhouette of dancing fauns as tall as the skirt itself. I've admired Oriana's dresses for their elegance and opulence, but these awaken in me a hunger for a dress that's riotous. They make me wish I'd seen Locke's mother in one of her gowns. They make me think she must have liked to laugh. I don't think I've ever seen a dress like any of these, I tell him. You really want me to wear one? He brushes a hand over a sleeve.
I guess they're a bit rotted.
No, I say. I like them. The one with the fawns is the least damaged. I dust it off and tug it on behind an old screen. I struggle, because it's the sort of dress that's difficult to put on without Tatterfell's help. I have no idea how to arrange my hair any differently, so I leave it as is, braided in a crown around my head. When I wipe off a silver mirror with my hand and see myself dressed in a dead fairy's clothes, a shudder goes through me. Suddenly, I do not know why I am here in this place. I am not sure of Locke's intentions. When he tries to drape me in his mother's jewels, I refuse them. Let's go out to the garden, I say. I no longer want to be in this empty, echoing room. He puts away the long string of emeralds he was holding. As we leave, I look back at the closet of moldering clothes. Despite my feelings of unease, there's a part of me that can't help imagining what it would be like to be the mistress of this place. Imagining Prince Dane with the crown. Imagining entertaining at the long table we kissed against, my classmates all drinking the pale green wine and pretending they had never tried to murder me. Locke, with his hand in mine. And me, spying on them all for the king. The hedge maze is taller than the height of an ogre and formed of dense, glossy leaves in a deep green. Apparently, Cardin's circle meets here often. I can hear them laughing at the center of the maze when I walk outside with Locke, late to his own gathering. The smell of pine liquor is alive in the air. The firelight of the torches makes long shadows and limns everything in scarlet. My steps slow. Reaching into the pocket of the borrowed dress, I touch my knife, still stained with Valyrian's blood. When I do, my fingers light on something else. Something Locke's mother must have left years before. I pull out her bauble, a golden acorn. It doesn't look like jewelry. There's no chain. And I cannot imagine what purpose it might have had other than to be pretty. I drop it back into my pocket. Locke holds my hand as we move through the turns of the hedge maze. It does not seem as though there are many. I try to map it in my mind as I go, in case I have to find my way out alone. The simplicity of the maze makes me nervous, rather than confident. I do not believe there are many simple things in Faerie. At home, dinner will be coming to a close without me. Taryn will be whispering to Vivi how I went somewhere with Locke. Maddock will be frowning and stabbing his meat, annoyed with me for missing his lessons. I have braved worse things. At the center of the maze, a piper is playing a lilting, wild song. White rose petals blow through the air. Folk are gathered, eating and drinking from a long banquet table that seems mostly piled with different distillations. Cordials in which mandrake roots float. Sour plum wine. A clear liquor infused with handfuls of red clover. And beside those, vials of golden nevermore. Cardin is lying on a blanket, his head tipped back and his loose white shirt unbuttoned. Although it is still early in the night, he appears to be very drunk. His mouth is flaked with gold. A horned girl, I don't know, is kissing his throat. And another, this one with daffodil hair, presses her mouth against the calf of his leg, just above the top of his boot. To my relief, I do not see Valyrian. I hope he's home, nursing that wound I gave him. Locke brings me a thimbleful of liquor, and I take a tiny scalding sip for the sake of politeness. I start coughing immediately. At that moment, Cardin's gaze goes to me. His eyes are barely open, but I can see the shine of them, wet as tar. He watches me as the girl kisses his mouth, watches me as she slides her hand beneath the hem of his silly, ruffly shirt. My cheeks heat. I look away, and then I'm angry with myself for giving him the satisfaction of seeming uncomfortable. He's the one who's making a spectacle of himself.
I see a member of the Circle of Worms has chosen to grace us with her presence tonight,
Nikasia says, swanning up to us in a dress with all the colors of the sunset in it. She peers into my face.
But which one is it?
The one you don't like, I tell her, ignoring her jibe. That makes her give a high, false laugh.
Oh, you might be surprised how some of us feel about both of you.
I promised you better amusements than this, Locke says stiffly, taking my elbow.
I am grateful when he pulls me toward a low table with pillows strewn haphazardly around it, but I can't help giving Nikasia a small, antagonizing wave as I go. I pour out my thimble of liquor onto the grass when Locke isn't looking. The piper finishes, and a naked boy, shining with gold paint, takes out a lyre and sings a filthy song about broken hearts.
O lady fair, O lady cruel, how I miss your sweet misrule. I miss your hair, I miss your eyes, but most of all, I miss your thighs.
Locke kisses me again, in front of the fire. Everyone can see it, but I don't know if they're looking, because I close my eyes as tightly as they will go. Chapter 17. I wake in Locke's house on a bed covered in tapestries. My mouth tastes of sour plums and is swollen from kissing. Locke is beside me on the bed, eyes shut, still in his party clothes. I pause in the act of rising to study him. His sharp ears and fox fur hair, the softness of his mouth. His long limbs spread out in sleep. His head is pillowed on one ruffle-covered wrist. The night comes back in a rush of memory. There was dancing and a chase through the maze. I remember falling on my hands in the dirt and laughing, totally unlike myself. Indeed, when I look down at the borrowed ball gown I slept in, there are grass stains on it. Not that I'd be the first to green gown her. Prince Cardan watched me all night, a shark restlessly circling, waiting for the right moment to bite. Even now I can conjure the memory of the scorched black of his eyes. And if I laughed louder for the sake of angering him, if I smiled wider and kissed Locke longer, that is a kind of deceit that even the folk cannot condemn. Now, however, the night feels like one long, impossible dream. Locke's bedroom is messy. Books and clothes scattered on divans and low couches. I wade through to the door and pad over the empty halls of the house. Finding my way back to the dusty room of his mother's, I take off her gown and tug on yesterday's clothes. I reach to take my knife from her pocket, and when I do, the golden acorn comes out with it. Impulsively, I tuck both knife and acorn into my tunic. I want some memento of the night. Something to recall it. Should nothing like it ever happen again. Locke told me I could borrow anything in the room. And I am borrowing this. On my way out, I pass the long dining table. Nikasia is there, sectioning an apple with a little knife.
"Your hair looks like a thicket," she says, popping a slice of fruit into her mouth.
I glance at a silver plate on the wall, which shows only a distorted and blurred image of myself. Even in that, I can tell she's right. A halo of brown surrounds my head. Reaching up, I begin undoing my braid, combing it out with my fingers. "Locke's asleep," I say, assuming that she's waiting to see him. I expect to feel as though I have something over her, being the one that came from his bedroom. But what I actually feel is a little bit of panic. I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to wake up in a boy's house and talk to the girl with whom he had a relationship. That she's also a girl who probably wants me dead is, oddly, the only part of this that feels at all normal.
"My mother and his brother thought we were to be wed," she says, seeming as though she might be talking to the air and not to me at all. "It was going to be a useful alliance."
"With Locke?" I ask, confused. She gives me an annoyed look, my question seeming to bring her briefly out of her story.
"Cardan and me. He ruins things. That's what he likes. To ruin things."
Of course Cardan likes to ruin things. I wonder how that could be something she only just realized. I would have thought that would be something they had in common. I leave her to her apple and her reminiscences and head toward the palace. A cool breeze blows through the trees, lifting my loose hair and bringing me the scent of pine. In the sky, I hear the call of gulls. I am grateful for the lecture today, glad to have an excuse for not going home and hearing whatever Oriana has to say to me. Today, the lecture is in the tower, my least favorite location. I climb the steps and settle myself. I am late, but I find a spot on a bench near the back. Taryn is sitting on the other side. She looks at me once, raising her brows. Cardan is beside her, dressed in green velvet, with golden stitching picking out thorns tipped in blue thread. He lounges in his seat, long fingers tapping restlessly against the wood of the bench beside him. Looking at him makes me feel equally restless. At least Valyrian hasn't shown up. It is too much to hope that he never returns, but at least I have today. A new instructor, a knight named Dulcamera, is talking about rules of inheritance, probably in anticipation of the coming coronation. The coronation, which will mark my rise to power as well. Once Prince Dane is the High King, his spies can haunt the shadows of Elfheim with only Dane himself to keep us in check.
In some of the lower courts, a king or queen's murderer can take the throne,
Dulcamera says. She goes on to tell us that she is part of the court of termites, which has not yet joined Eldred's banner. Although she is not wearing armor, she stands as though she's used to the weight of it.
And that is why Queen Mab bargained with the Wild Fae to make the crown King Eldred wears, which can only be passed down to her descendants. It would be tricky to get it by force.
She grins wickedly. If Cardin were to try to stop her lesson, she looks like she would eat him alive and crack his bones for marrow. The gentry children look at Dulcamera uncomfortably. Rumor has it that Lord Roybon, her king, is planning to swear to the new High King, bringing with him his large court, one that has held off Maddox's forces for years. Roybon's joining the High Court of Elfheim is widely considered to be a master stroke of diplomacy, negotiated by Prince Dane against Maddox's wishes. I suppose she's come for the coronation. Larkspur, one of the youngest of us, pipes up.
What happens when there are no more children in the Greenbriar line?
Dulcamera's smile gentles.
Once there are fewer than two descendants, one to wear the crown and the other to place it on the ruler's head, the High Crown and its power crumble. All of Elfheim will be free from their oaths to it. Then, who knows, maybe a new ruler will make a new crown. Maybe you'll return to warring with smaller Seelie and Unseelie courts. Maybe you will join our banners in the southwest.
Her smile makes it clear which of those she would prefer. I stick up my hand. Dulcamera nods in my direction. What if someone tries to take the crown? Cardin gives me a look. I want to glare, but I can't help thinking of him sprawled out on the ground with those girls. My cheeks heat all over again. I drop my gaze.
An interesting question, Dulcamera says. Legend has it that the crown will not allow itself to be placed on the brow of anyone who isn't an heir of Mab. But Mab's line has been very fruitful. So long as a pair of descendants try to take the crown, it could be done. But the most dangerous part of a coup would be this. The crown is cursed, so that a murder of its wearer causes the death of the person responsible.
I think of the note I found in Balekin's house, about blusher mushrooms, about vulnerability. After the lecture, I go down the steps carefully, remembering taking them at a run after stabbing Valyrian. My vision blurs, and I feel dizzy for a moment. But the moment passes. Taryn, coming behind me, all but pushes me into the woods once we're outside.
First of all, she says, tugging me over patches of curling ferns. No one knows you weren't home all last night except for Tatterfell, and I gave her one of your nicest rings to make sure she wouldn't say anything. But you have to tell me where you were.
Locke had a party at his house, I say. I stayed, but it wasn't... I mean, nothing much happened. We kissed, that was it. Her chestnut braids fly as she shakes her head.
I don't know if I believe that.
I let out my breath, perhaps a little dramatically. Why would I lie? I'm not the one hiding the identity of the person courting me. Taryn frowns.
I just think that sleeping in someone's room, in someone's bed, is more than kissing.
My cheeks heat, thinking of the way it had felt to wake up with his body stretched out beside mine. To get the attention off me, I start speculating about her.
Ooh, maybe it's Prince Balekin,
Are you going to marry Prince Bailkin? Or perhaps it's Noggle, and you can count the stars together.
She smacks me in the arm, a little too hard.
Stop guessing, she says. You know I'm not allowed to say.
Ow. I pick a white campion flower and stick it behind my ear.
So you like him? She asks. Really like him? Locke? I ask.
Of course I do.
She gives me a look, and I wonder how much I worried her, not coming home the night before. Bailkin I like less well, I say. And she rolls her eyes. When we get back to the stronghold, I find that Matic has left word he will be out until late. With little else to do for once, I look for Taryn, but although I saw her go upstairs just minutes before, she's not in her room. Instead, her dress is on the bed and her closet open, a few gowns hanging roughly, as though she pulled them out before finding them wanting. Has she gone to meet her suitor? I take a turn around the room, trying to see it as a spy might, alert for signs of secrets. I notice nothing unusual but a few rose petals withering on her dressing table. I go to my room and lie on my bed, going over my memories of the night before. Reaching into my pocket, I remove my knife to finally clean it. When I bring it out, I am holding the golden acorn, too. I turn the bauble over in my hand. It's a solid lump of metal, a beautiful object. At first, I take it only for that, before I notice the tiny lines running across it. Tiny lines that seem to indicate moving parts, as though it were a puzzle. I can't screw off the top, although I try. I can't seem to do anything else with it either. I'm about to give up and toss it onto my dressing table when I glimpse a tiny hole, so small as to be nearly invisible, right at the bottom. Hopping off my bed, I rattle through my desk, looking for a pin. The one I find has a pearl on one end. I try to fit the point into the acorn. It takes a moment, but I manage, pushing past resistance until I feel a click, and it opens. Mechanized steps swing out from a shining center, where a tiny golden bird rests. Its beak moves, and it speaks in a creaky little voice.
My dearest friend, these are the last words of Liriope. I have three golden birds to scatter. Three attempts to get one into your hand. I am too far gone for any antidote. And so, if you hear this, I leave you with the burden of my secrets and the last wish of my heart. Protect him. Take him far from the dangers of this court. Keep him safe. And never, ever tell him the truth of what happened to me.
Tatterfell comes into the room, bringing with her a tray with tea things. She tries to peek at what I am doing, but I cut my hand over the acorn. When she goes out, I set down the bauble and pour myself a cup of tea, holding it to warm my hands. Liriope is Locke's mother. This seems like a message asking someone, her dearest friend, to spirit him, Locke, away. She calls the message her last words. So she must have known she was about to die. Perhaps the acorns were to be sent to Locke's father, in the hopes Locke might spend the rest of his life exploring wild places with him, rather than be caught up in intrigues. But since Locke is still here, it seems as if none of the three acorns were found. Maybe none of them even left her bower. I should give it to him. Let him decide for himself what to do with it. But all I keep thinking about is the note on Bailkin's desk. The note that seemed to implicate Bailkin in Liriope's murder. Should I tell Locke everything? I know the provenance of the blusher mushroom that you ask after. But what you do with it must not be tied to me. I turn the words over in my mind the way I turned the acorn in my hand, and I feel the same seams. There's something odd about that sentence.
I copy it out again on a piece of paper to be sure I remember it correctly. When I first read it, the note seemed to imply that Queen Orla had located a deadly poison for Baelkin. But blusher mushrooms, while rare, grow wild, even on this island. I picked blusher mushrooms in the Milkwood, beside the black-thorned bees, who build their hives high in the trees. An antidote can be made with their honey, I learned recently from all my reading. Blusher mushrooms aren't dangerous if you don't drink the red liquid. What if Queen Orla's note didn't mean that she'd found blusher mushrooms and she was going to give them to Baelkin? What if by know the provenance, Orla literally just meant that she knew where particular blusher mushrooms had come from? After all, she says, what you do with it, and not what you do with them. She's cautioning him about what he's going to do with the knowledge, not the actual mushrooms. Which means he's not going to poison Dane. It also means that Baelkin may have uncovered who caused Locke's mother's death, if he found out who had the blusher mushrooms that killed her. The answer could have been there, among the other papers that I, in my eagerness, had overlooked. I have to go back. I have to get back into the tower. Today, before the coronation is any closer. Because maybe Baelkin isn't going to try to kill Dane at all, and the Court of Shadows has the wrong idea. Or, if they have the right idea, he isn't going to do it with blusher mushrooms. Gulping down my tea, I find the servant garb in the back of my closet. I take down my hair and arrange it in an approximation of the rough braid that the girls in Baelkin's house wore. I tuck my knife high on my thigh and shake out some of my silver box of salt into my pocket. Then I grab for my cloak, toe on my leather shoes, and I'm out the door, palms starting to sweat. I have learned a lot more since my first foray into Hollow Hall, enough to make me understand better the risks I was taking. That does nothing for my nerves. Given what I saw of him with Cardan, I am not at all confident I could endure what Baelkin would do to me if he caught me. Taking a deep breath, I remind myself not to get caught. That's what the Roach says a spy's real job is. The information is secondary. The job is not to get caught. In the hall, I pass Orianna. She looks me up and down. I have to resist the urge to pull the cloak more tightly around myself. She is wearing a gown the color of unripe mulberries, and her hair is pulled slightly back. The very tips of her pointed ears are covered in shimmering crystal cuffs. I am a little envious of them. If I wore them, they'd disguise the human roundness of my own ears. "You came home very late last night," she says, annoyance pulling at her mouth. "You missed dinner, and your father was expecting you to spar with him." "I'll do better," I say, then instantly regret the declaration, because I am probably not going to be back for dinner tonight, either. "Tomorrow. I'll start doing better tomorrow." "Faithless creature," Orianna says, looking at me as though through the sheer intensity of her gaze she might ferret out my secrets. "You're scheming." I am so tired of her suspicion. So very tired. "You always think that," I say. "It's just that for once, you're right." Leaving her to worry what that might mean, I go down the stairs and out onto the grass. This time, there's no one in my way. No one to make me reconsider what I'm about to do. I don't bring the toad this time. I am more careful. As I walk through the woods, I see an owl encircling overhead. I pull the hood of my cape to cover my face. At Hollow Hall, I stow my cloak outside between the logs of a woodpile and enter through the kitchens, where supper is being prepared. Squabs are lacquered with rose jelly, the smell of their crackling skin enough to make my mouth water and my stomach clench. I open a cabinet, and I'm greeted by a dozen candles, all of them the color of buffed leather and accented with a gold stamp of Baelkin's personal crest, three laughing blackbirds. I take out 9 candles and, trying to move as mechanically as possible, carry them past the guards. One guard gives me an odd look. I am sure there is something off about me, but he's seen my face before, and I am more sure-footed than last time. At least until I see Baelkin coming down the stairs. He glances in my direction, and it is all I can do to keep my head down, my step even. I carry the candles into the room in front of me, which turns out to be the library. To my immense relief, he doesn't seem to truly see me. My heart is speeding, though. My breath's coming too fast. The servant girl who is cleaning the grate in Cardin's room is blurrily putting books back onto the shelves. She is as I remember her. Cracked lips. Thin. And bruise-eyed. Her movements are slow, as if the air were as thick as water. In her drugged dream, I am no more interesting than the furniture, and of less consequence. I scan the shelves impatiently, but I can see nothing useful. I need to get up to the tower, to go through all of Prince Baelkin's correspondence, and hope I find something to do with Locke's mother, or Dane, or the coronation. Something I overlooked. But I can't do anything with Baelkin between me and the stairs. I look at the girl again. I wonder what her life is like here. What she dreams of. If she ever, for a moment, had a chance to get away. At least, thanks to the Gesh, if Baelkin did catch me, this could not be my fate. I wait, counting to 1,000, while piling my candles on a chair. Then, I look out. Thankfully, Baelkin is gone. Quickly, I head up the stairs toward the tower. I hold my breath as I pass Cardin's door, but luck is with me. It is shut tight. Then I am up the stairs and into Baelkin's study. I note the herbs in the jars around the room. Herbs I see with new eyes. A few are poisonous, but most are just narcotic. Nowhere do I see blusher mushrooms. I go to his desk and wipe my hands against the rough cloth of my dress, trying to leave no trace of sweat, trying to memorize the pattern of papers. There are 2 letters from Matic, but they just seem to be about which knights will be at the coronation and what pattern around the central dais. There are others that seem to be about assignations, about revels and parties and debauches. Nothing about blusher mushrooms, nothing about poisons at all. Nothing about liriope or murder. The only thing that seems even a little surprising is a bit of doggerel, a love poem in Prince Dane's hand, about a woman who remains unidentified, except by her sunrise hair and starlit eyes. Worse, nothing I can find tells me anything about a plan to move against Prince Dane. If Baelkin is going to murder his brother, he's smart enough not to leave evidence lying around. Even the letter about the blusher mushroom is gone. I have risked coming to Hollow Hall for nothing. For a moment, I just stand there, trying to corral my thoughts. I need to leave without drawing attention to myself. A messenger. I will disguise myself as a messenger. Messages run in and out of estates all the time. I take a blank sheet of paper and scrawl Matic on one side, then seal the other with wax. The sulfur of the match hangs in the air for a moment. As it dissipates, I descend the steps, faked message in hand. When I pass the library, I hesitate. The girl is still inside, mechanically lifting books from a pile and placing them on shelves. She will keep doing that until she's told to do something else. Until she collapses. Until she fades away, unremembered. As if she were nothing. I cannot leave her here. I don't have anything to go back to in the mortal world, but she might. And yes, It's a betrayal of Prince Dane's faith in me. A betrayal of Fairy itself. I know that. But all the same, I can't leave her. There's a kind of relief in realizing it. I walk into the library, setting down the note on a table. She does not turn, does not react at all. I reach into my pocket and cup a little salt in the center of my palm. I hold it out to her, the way I would if I were coaxing a horse with sugar. "Eat this," I tell her in a low voice. She turns toward me, although her gaze doesn't focus.
"I'm not allowed," she says, voice rough with disuse. "No salt. You're not supposed to."
I clap my hand over her mouth, some of the salt tipping out onto the ground, the rest pressed against her lips. I am an idiot. An impulsive idiot. Locking my arm around her, I drag her deeper into the library. She's alternating between trying to shout and trying to bite me. She keeps scratching at my arms, her nails digging into my skin. I hold her there, against the wall, until she sags, until the fight goes out of her. "I'm sorry," I whisper as I hold on. "I'm winging it. I don't want to hurt you. I want to save you. Please let me do this. Let me save you." Finally, she has been still long enough that I take a chance and pull my hand away. She's panting, breaths coming fast. She doesn't scream, though, which seems like a good sign. "We're getting out of here," I tell her. "You can trust me." She gives me a look of blank incomprehension. "Just act like everything's normal." I pull her to her feet and realize the impossibility of what I'm asking. Her eyes are rolling in her head like a mad pony. I don't know how long we have until she completely loses it. Still, there is nothing for me to do but march her out of Hollow Hall as fast as I can. I stick my head into the main chamber. It's still empty, so I drag her from the library. She's looking around as though she's seeing the heavy wooden staircase and the gallery above for the first time. Then I remember I left my fake note on the table in the library. "Hold on," I say. "I have to go back and..." She makes a plaintive sound and pulls against my grip. I drag her along with me anyway and grab the message. I crumple it up and stuff it into my pocket. It's useless now, when the guards could recall it and connect a servant girl's disappearance to the household of the person who stole her. "What's your name?" The girl shakes her head. "You must remember it," I insist. It's terrible that instead of being sympathetic, I am annoyed. "Buck up," I think. "Stop feeling your feelings. Let's go."
"Sophie,"
she says in a kind of sob. Tears are starting in her eyes. I feel worse and worse still for how cruel I am about to be. "You are not allowed to cry," I tell her as harshly as I can, hoping my tone will scare her into listening. I try my best to sound like Maddock, to sound as if I'm used to having my commands obeyed. "You must not cry. I will slap you if I have to." She cringes but subsides into silence. I wipe her eyes with the back of my hand. "Okay?" I ask her. When she doesn't answer, I figure there's no more point in conversation. I steer her toward the kitchens. We'll have to pass by guards. There's no other way out. She has pasted on a horrible rictus of a smile, but at least she has enough self-possession for that. More worrying is the way she can't stop staring at things. As we walk toward the guards, the intensity of her gaze is impossible to disguise. I improvise, trying to sound as though I am reciting a memorized message without inflection in the words. "Prince Cardin says we are to attend him." One of the guards turns to the other.
"Bilgen won't like that."
I try not to react, but it's hard. I just stand there and wait. If they lunge at us, I'm going to have to kill them.
Very well, the first guard says. Go, but inform Cardin that his brother demands he bring both of you back this time.
I don't like the sound of that. The second guard glances over at Sophie and her wild eyes.
What do you see?
I can feel her trembling beside me, her whole body shaking. I need to say something fast before she does.
Lord Cardin told us to be more observant, I say, hoping that the plausible confusion of an ambiguous command will help to explain the way she's acting.
Then I walk on with Sophie through the kitchens, past the human servants I am not saving, aware of the futility of my actions. Does helping one person really matter? On balance? Once I have power, I will find a way to help them all, I tell myself. And once Dane is in power, I will have power. I make sure to keep my movement slow. I let myself breathe only when we have finally stepped outside. And it turns out, even that's too soon. Cardin is riding toward us on a tall, dappled gray horse. Behind him is a girl on a palfrey.
Nikasia.
As soon as he gets inside, the guards will ask him about us. As soon as he gets inside, he will know something is wrong. If he doesn't see me, and no sooner than that, what would be the punishment for stealing a prince's servant? I don't know. A curse, perhaps? Such as being turned into a raven and forced to fly north and live for 7 times 7 years in an ice palace. Or worse, no curse at all. An execution. It takes everything I've got not to break and run. It's not as though I think I could make it to the woods, especially not hauling a girl with me. He would ride us both down. Stop staring, I hiss at Sophie, harsher than I mean to. Look at your feet. Stop scolding me, she says. But at least she's not crying. I keep my head down and, looping her arm through mine, walk toward the woods. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Cardin swing down from his saddle, black hair blown by the wind. He looks in my direction and pauses for a moment. I suck in my breath and don't run. I can't run. There is no thundering of hoofbeats, no racing to catch and punish us. To my immense relief, he seems to see only 2 servants heading toward the forest, perhaps to gather wood or berries or something. The closer we get to the edge of the woods, the more each step feels fraught. Then Sophie sinks to her knees, turning to look back at Baelkin's manor. A keening sound comes from deep in her throat.
No, she says, shaking her head. No, 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 no. This isn't real. This didn't happen.
I jerk her up, digging my fingers into her armpit. Move, I say. Move, or I will leave you here. Do you understand me? I will leave you, and Prince Cardin will find you and drag you back inside. Cheating a glance back, I see him. He's off his horse and leading it to the stables. Nikasia still sits atop hers, her head tipped back, laughing at something he said. He's smiling too, but it's not his usual sneer. He doesn't look like the wicked villain from a story. He looks like an inhuman boy out for a walk with his friend in the moonlight. Sophie staggers onward. We can't get caught now. Not when we're so close. The moment when I cross into the pine needle-strewn woods, I let out an enormous breath. I keep her moving until we reach the stream. I make her walk through it, though the cold water and sucking mud slows us down. Any way of hiding our tracks is worth doing. Eventually, she sinks down on the bank and gives over to weeping. I watch her, wishing I knew what to do. Wishing I was a better, more sympathetic person. Instead of being annoyed and worried that any delay is going to get us caught, I make myself sit on the remains of a termite-eaten log on the bank of the stream and let her cry. But when minutes have passed and her tears haven't stopped, I go over and kneel in the muddy grass. "It's not far to my house," I say, trying to sound persuasive. "Just a little more walking."
"Shut up," she shouts, lifting her hand to ward me off.
Frustration flares. I want to scream at her. I want to shake her. I bite my tongue and fist my hands to make myself stop. "Okay," I say, taking a deep breath. "This is happening fast, I know, but I really do want to help you. I can get you out of Fairy tonight." The girl is shaking her head again.
"I don't know," she says. "I don't know. I was at Burning Man, and there was this guy who said he had this gig passing hors d'oeuvres for a rich weirdo in one of the air-conditioned tents. Just don't take anything, he told me. If you do, you will have to serve me for 1,000 years.
Her voice trails off, but now I see how she was trapped. It must have sounded like he was making a joke. She must have laughed, and he must have smiled. And then, whether she ate a single shrimp puff or pocketed some of the silverware, it would all be the same. "It's okay," I say nonsensically. "It's going to be okay." She looks at me and seems to see me for the first time. Takes in that I am dressed like her, like a servant, but that there's something off about me.
"Who are you? What is this place? What happened to us?"
I asked for her name, so I guess I should give her mine. "I'm Jude. I grew up here. One of my sisters, she can take you over the sea to the human town near here. From there, you can call someone to get you, or you can go to the police, and they'll find your people. This is almost over." Sophie takes this in.
"Is this some kind of... what happened? I remember things... impossible things. And I wanted... no, I couldn't have wanted..."
Her voice trails off, and I don't know what to say. I cannot guess the end of her sentence.
"Please, just tell me this isn't real. I don't think I can live with any of this being real."
She's looking around the forest, as though if she can prove it isn't magic, then nothing else is either. Which is stupid. All forests are magic. "Come on," I say, because while I don't like the way she's talking, there's no point in lying for the sake of making her feel better. She's going to have to accept that she's been trapped in Fairy. It's not as if I have a boat to take her across the water. All I have are Vivi's ragwort steeds. "Can you walk a little farther now? The faster she's back in the human world, the better." As I get closer to Maddox, I remember my cloak. Still bunched up and hidden in a woodpile outside Hollow Hall. And curse myself all over again. Leading Sophie to the stables, I seat her in an empty stall. She slumps on the hay. I think the glimpse of the giant toad undid the last of her trust in me. "Here we are," I say with forced cheerfulness. "I'm going inside to get my sister, and I want you to wait right here. Promise me." She gives me a terrible look. "I can't do this. I can't face this." "You have to." My voice comes out harsher than I intended. I stalk into the house and go up the steps as quickly as I can, hoping against hope that I don't run into anyone else on the way. I fling open the door to Vivienne's room without bothering to knock. Vivi, thankfully, is lying on her bed, writing a letter in green ink with drawings of hearts and stars and faces in the margins. She looks up when I come in, tossing back her hair.
That's an interesting outfit you've got on.
I did something really stupid, I say, out of breath. That makes her push herself up, sliding off the bed and onto her feet.
What happened?
I stole a human girl, a human servant, from Prince Baelkin. And I need you to help me get her back to the mortal world before anyone finds out. As I say this, I realize all over again how ridiculous it was for me to do that. How risky. How foolish. He will just find another human willing to make a bad bargain. But Vivi doesn't chide me.
Okay, let me put on my shoes. I thought you were going to tell me you'd killed someone.
Why would you think that? I ask. She snorts as she searches around for boots. Her eyes meet mine as she does up the laces.
Jude,